please state your name and spell it out for us?
My name is Roger Riga, R-I-G-A.
Okay. And could you let us know what your title was when you're working with MVRPC and the approximate dates that you worked with them?
I worked with MVRPC from 1971 to 1976, and I had various titles. I started off as a planner. I don't know that I recall the specific level of planner. When I left, I was an assistant director.
All right.
Or deputy director.
Deputy director.
One or the other.
Okay.
For comprehensive planning, I believe.
Okay. And sorry, did you mention the approximate dates there?
Yes. As I said, from 71 to 76.
Okay. Great. Sorry, just having a couple of issues with the sound here. All right. I did send over, my abstract. I was just wondering, though, if you could give us a bit of background and tell us how you got into planning and specifically how you came to MVRPC.
Okay. Well, I studied planning at the University of Cincinnati and got my undergraduate degree there. While I was there, it was a co-op program, and I worked at various places, but among them, the city of Cincinnati, and subsequently the Community Action Commission in the Cincinnati area, both of which Ann Schaefer was working at the time that I was there.
Uh-huh.
So that's where that connection came in to begin with. Upon graduation, I took a position in Flint, Michigan as a planner and worked there from 1966 to, I believe it was around 1968 or 69, and after which I went to the city of Alexandria, Virginia, and was there for about a year, then moved to Downtown Progress in Washington, D.C., which is a private nonprofit focusing on downtown redevelopment planning.
Mm-hmm.
And it was from that location that Ann happened to come to Washington and on some trip, and we talked and we got together, and she was saying that they were looking for someone particularly to help out in the housing program that could use some of my specialty, which was numbers, economic projections, that type, demographic projections, that sort of thing. And what they were looking for and what I provided to them was someone to assist in redoing the housing allocation formulas for the plan. So for version 2 of the plan, let's say.
So this was the 1970 version then?
This would have been the 1970 version was the original version, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was an additional version that was done, I'll say 72, 73, something like that.
Yes, I believe it was published in 1973, so...
Yes, and it was for that edition which there was a revision to the formulas for the development or estimation of what the fair share would be.
Okay.
And it was the work on developing those formulas that was my focus.
Okay. And so you would have you would have spoken with Anne then in maybe 1971 or so?
I believe it would have been 1971. Would have been around November of 71, I believe.
Okay. And did you, since you were involved with the planning community, was there any talk of the Dayton plan? Were you aware of it
I
before?
mean, I was aware of it, in terms of it going on, and I had interest in it, and I was aware of it also because Ann and I had maintained some contact during that period.
Of course. So, when you entered then in 1971, a very interesting time for the plan, of course. The plan had been passed and accepted by 26 and eventually all of the commissioners. But the hard work of implementation then was going to start, I guess.
Well, yes, and I think one of the things that was, people were, let's say there was a basic buy-in to the concept, okay? At least that was my understanding and feeling of it, that there was a buy-in to the concept, but the question was, they needed to come up with some way, or maybe perhaps a better way of estimating or computing a fair share. What was a fair share? Now, a fair share, it's not something that there are no predictive models for that. It's not a scientific measure, that's a political measure. So we needed a tool that could bring in the various factors that were there and that needed to be reflected into the tool in developing what that fair share would be. And as I think the, if you based a formula solely on need, and you want to translate need as where the demand for the housing was, it was most clearly in Dayton. But on the other hand, other communities needed and wanted some moderate income housing, low income housing. They had needs in their own communities. So they didn't want all of it sucked into Dayton, if you will. On the other hand, they weren't looking for something that was just a dispersal plan. I mean, you could trigger it in such a way that it would send it everywhere else, just send it everywhere else. Well, that wasn't going to be what was desired either. So what we were looking for was a way to take both the current needs and needs of existing populations and forecasts, and the fact of what other needs were in the region, and to try to balance these various things in some kind of a formula that could get political acceptance to do that. And that was what was worked on in trying to put that second level together. And I think we were reasonably successful in doing so, and it was subsequently approved.
That was going to be my question. Was it, so I believe it was Minnie Johnson who put together the initial formula. Is that correct?
I believe it was. I this is since I wasn't there, but I believe it was Minnie's work, yes.
Yeah. So I was just wondering if the improvements were actually in the w if the I was wondering if the improvements were needed in terms of you needed a more sort of scientific solution or whether or not you needed a political solution. Or both, maybe.
My view was that you needed a political solution, but you needed to be able to provide a scientific or pseudo-scientific, if you will, path that supported that. Okay? It wasn't just, well, this is what we'll sell, you know, or what we can sell, but there needed to be some logic in what we were doing to try to relate to the differences, to the different needs that existed.
Of course.
So it was, it's hard to call it science on the one hand. But it had that bent to it.
Sure. And on the one hand, it was a way of maybe forging more of a scientific solution to the problem, and from MVRPC's standpoint, and also given Dayton's political or Dayton's culture of planning and sort of respect for management, it might have aided in making the plan more politically appealing.
Yes,
to various municipalities.
It would give credence.
Yes.
To it.
Good.
You needed something to reinforce it. There was a level of political commitment. Could we do what we were doing in a way that reinforced that a little bit? And remember, the first plan, which would have been done in 1970, I'm not positive on this, but as I recall, that probably would have relied primarily on 1960 census data and follow-up, because 70 data would not have been available at that time. So you had the 70 census coming in, and some of that data was starting to come in. And at least issues that came up there and other places were the fact that you could start to see some of the changes and subsequent decline in the population in the city of Dayton, and some of the changes that were occurring.
Yeah, could you speak a bit about those changes? Because just to contextualize it, in the 1970 plan, they talked about how Dayton was in severe need of housing. There was only a 2% vacancy rate, but the census, I guess, and other bits of information that had come to light by 1971 or two might have qualified that.
It was qualifying it some, and let's say by, I don't remember how much of this entered into the housing plan work itself, but by let's say 74, 75, our estimates at MVRPC were that the city of Dayton was going to see decline, even though that had not, I don't think that had been reflected yet in the 70 census.
Okay.
But the analysis of what was going on and the trends of what was happening showed a different picture in Dayton. If you have a city that's continuing to grow, you can deal with issues in the growth. But as you start to decline, you have a different situation in how to deal with them.
Mm. Yeah.
And
please go ahead.
And of course, that was going on, and while, as I say, I don't know how much this was reflected in the housing plan itself, but obviously the city of Dayton was not anxious, was not looking favorably on decline at that point.
Right.
You know.
Yeah. So, once you came up with the new. Do you remember offhand what some of the changes were to the 1970 plan in terms of your formula, and maybe in sort of layman's terms as well? Sure. No, that's great. No, that does clarify some things. Yes, I do believe I do believe I have that. Yes. So
And that particular document was primarily my work.
okay, great. And could you talk a little bit about how, so MVRPC, of course, was dealing with allocation of units and not explicitly in the actual, it wasn't building units, but it was involved in the process of building units.
Well, what it was doing was using the process to, in the I would say it was in the A95 process, I think, at that point, in the reviewing of projects, and how did the projects relate to the allocations? Were they supporting it, or were they doing something else?
Do you remember any salient examples of various municipalities that may have, by the time you got there, started building with vigor or with not a little bit of hand-wringing?
I don't have any recollection of that at this point at all.
Okay. So then, 1973 comes around, and Nixon puts a moratorium on all housing efforts. Or actually, maybe we could back up a tiny bit there. So again, getting units built, that process looked like A95 coming to MVRPC and either signing off on the building or not. Do you remember how cooperative other agencies that would have helped to build these units were at the time?
I was probably getting less involved,
Yeah.
okay?
Yeah.
And my assignment shifted. My primary assignment, I won't say I didn't spend any time on it, but my primary assignment was shifting into working on the comprehensive plan and land use projections for the communities. So, in terms of this, where I was in the process, I still had a, let's say, a finger in it, when it, particularly when it came up to numbers issues. But in terms of the policy end of it, that was not my bailiwick.
Right. And that was what year was that you started to?
I would say that probably was around the time after that was passed. I mean, we did what we wanted to do, which was revise the plan.
Right.
Okay?
Yeah.
And as we were then moving into a detailing of the regional land use planning, which had not really, not much had been done in that area. So that was the area that we were starting to move in, and we were working in 72, they passed the Water Pollution Control Act, and then as part of that included area-wide waste treatment management planning, which was another area that we had not done a whole lot in, and the agency decided that it wanted to move forward in that, and at that time, the federal government was kind of dragging its feet on that, and instead of embracing all of the, let's say, or trying to get as many of the large urban areas undertaking the area-wide waste treatment planning, they made a policy decision to go ahead and approve, only allocate funds and approve 12 of these programs throughout the country. And this was announced in the spring of 74, I believe. And the program was to start in July. And we sat down. I remember sitting down with Dale and saying, is this where we want to go? And he said, yes. And I said, I'll go after it for you. So that's what I did. And pursued getting that grant and was successful in doing so. And we started, I think we heard 2 weeks after the 1st of July that we had a grant effective July 1st. And for the next 2 years, that's what I focused myself on entirely, was that area-wide waste treatment management planning. And then having done it there, being one of those first 12, I was in a unique position to transfer that to another agency and move to Skag in Southern California.
Right. And you did move in did you say it was 1976?
Yeah, it was November of 76.
Yeah, 1976. Okay. Let's see. Sorry, just looking over my notes here. Okay, so as in terms of the comprehensive plan, What were some various what were some of the focuses in terms of the plan? So how to what extent was housing involved in it, and to what extent was your comprehensive plan sort of standard, or if did it take a different tact in terms of its composition?
Well, the first thing that we, okay, I forget exactly when MVRPC was founded, but back in the early 60s, there was a, let's say, a really general map that had been put together, that talked about the future region, which didn't look much different than the current region, to be honest. And one of the things that we saw was one of the questions was where could we actually anticipate the growth to be? This would of course have impacts in the housing area in terms of where you would need housing of various sorts, but there was our whole system, which I think you noted in some of the things. Ohio is a competitive environment, and the competitive environment for development is not such that it lends itself really to long-range planning, since the most money in the system can be made by doing something outside of the scope of the plan. If you think about you don't get the most money by developing a piece of zoned industrial land for industry. You've paid for industry. You get the most money by taking a piece of farmland and rezoning it to some other purpose. Industrial, commercial, doesn't matter. It will matter how much and what, but that's how you get the bucks. You take something that wasn't planned, you buy it at one price and sell it at another. And of course, you've got the whole thing of jurisdictions competing for tax base. That's true no matter where you are, but particularly in the way the role of property taxes, et cetera, are. There's a lot of competition for, do you want it in the township, in the communities, outside the communities? How do you want to do this? So what we were moving toward was doing that. So the first stages were to just kind of define what we already had and what was going on, and we were in the process of starting to do that. And that was in, as I say, we were getting started with that in the late 73, early 74 period, when the area-wide waste treatment management planning came along. And the thing that was happening there is the federal government recognized that with sewer grants, they were building more sewer than they needed. They were building, every community wanted the sewer to allow their growth to expand. So you ended up with everybody saying they were going to get the growth. Well, which community, where was it going to go? So part of what had to be done was that some of that definition of what would be the service area and the anticipated development in around the existing facilities and what new facilities would be there. I mean, there were other issues in the plan, but that was a big chunk of the plan and the issues. So it kind of married into our need to do land use planning, and we took that and used that to go off in both directions. doing. Also, got into things with the Department of Natural Resources, and they were starting to do computerized mapping of these things, and it took us in a lot of different directions.
Yeah. Was there a trend towards suburbanization of industry at the time in Dayton?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that was going on. Mm-hmm. I mean, the thing was, to build something or to do something just in the existing, to restrict growth to the existing areas, it's kind of expensive to do on one hand, if you think about it.
Mm.
You know, you can buy vacant land cheaper than you can buy developed land and clear it and prepare it for something, okay?
Right.
In the simplest terms.
Yeah.
So, unless you have a process of urban renewal or writing the cost of the land down one way or another, suburbanization is the low-cost option for any growth to occur.
Mm.
I mean, it isn't a decision of just wanting to go to the suburbs. It's a question of what's the least cost way of doing it.
Yes.
Now you get, it's not suburbanization, but it's moving it out of the community or moving it out of the country. But,
yeah.
You know, it's the same phenomena.
Yeah. Right. And so then I guess the looking at land use at the time, you then expected that some of the industries would probably move to the southern suburbs and places like this?
Well, I think you could see it going all over.
Uh-huh.
Okay? Certainly some would go to the southern suburbs, because the things, let's say there are multiple factors. It's not just the availability of cheap or lesser cost land, but where are their people, and where was the other infrastructure that would support this? And there was existing infrastructure, and it was possible to go there economically. Okay?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And
I mean, you have things that work economically, but may not be the policy desired. Now, here we're not talking about Dayton so much. It's just in general, you have the whole thing of, okay, you can locate it. Your cost can be least here, but there's other desires and other things that you're supporting. Yeah, there's a whole group of factors that go into a choice.
Yeah.
Only some of which move it to that area, and that's why some of the area filled in there that made a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
Economically, it may not have been the best thing from a housing mix or a distribution standpoint.
Mm.
You know, it may have had its, but nowhere have, I don't think here or anywhere else have we gotten, we're only getting better at projecting what all of these impacts are.
Hmm.
If you go back, you know, some of it was kind of guesswork, but we didn't have any good hard ways of projecting them.
Right. Sure. Could you explain a little bit more about the competitive nature of industry under Ohio law? I've heard a bit about this, but haven't really heard it explained. I mean, in the 1970s, say.
Well, I mean, area of expertise, but if you let me take a moment.
Sure.
Think about that. Jurisdictions compete for tax base. All of this comes, a lot of the land use and development competition and issues are a competition for tax base. If you've got tax base, your tax base allows you to do the other things that you need to perform the functions of government, or more of the functions of government, or do them better without raising as much taxes, because the tax base is going up. So to the degree that you can add new development and you can have growth, you can use that growth to pay the additional costs that are involved. Okay? Now, since there is nothing that says that if you take the development from area A and move it to the area B, that there's any compensation to anyone for that. Okay, there's no sharing of those revenues in any way. Where it is where who collects the taxes. And who collects the taxes is the one who gets to pay the bill, pay their bills. And if an industry moves out of somewhere else, someone's a winner, someone's a loser. I mean, in the simplest terms, that's what we're talking about. So there has been and it's not just Ohio, it's anywhere that has, unless there is a system in place to say, hey, we're going to share the benefits, or if someone of one way or another, or we're not going to, you can't move something from point A to point B without picking up the residual cost of doing so. But that's not built into the system. It isn't built into the...
Right.
Okay?
Yeah, that makes sense.
I mean, that's what we're talking about in the main.
Yeah. Yeah. And Ohio is not exceptional in that.
No.
Okay.
I mean, there are places where they have tried, and various things have been done to do differently, and I haven't followed them. But to the degree that you can come up with a successful system for balancing things, you can make decisions on a more rational basis that aren't just on the basis of we need the money. I mean, everybody needs the money, but who's better at getting it?
Yeah, sure. Definitely. Well, great. So I was just wondering also if you just had anything, any other anecdotes from your time at MVRPC?
Not really.
Yeah. Did you see? I did want to ask if what role you saw Dale Birch playing in the whole operation, and the team more generally, the staff.
Pardon me, the team.
Yeah, the team, the staff, Dale Birch's leadership.
Yeah, I mean, Dale was a person who had his. I'll say his finger was on the pulse of what was going on. He knew how to listen to the complaints, needs, whatever, and understand and develop a certain amount of empathy, even in people that might disagree with him philosophically on some issues. He didn't make people feel bad about who they were or what they Dark County had its issues too, you know.
Yeah.
As did the southern suburbs. It wasn't all just about Dayton. Now, he understood, and he did a very good job of balancing those interests and keeping the various political interests of the suburbs and the rural and the urban communities representing, all of them feeling that their interests were represented. Maybe not as much as they wanted in every case, but at least to a degree, and that they had a voice and could participate. And he was very good at making that happen. Okay? And bringing that about, aside from the fact that he had, there were things he was dedicated to, including the housing program, you know, to making that work. It was only in making it work and in being a good communicator and leader of a regional agency. I mean, that there's this whole thing of getting regional cooperation. There are a vast number of different interests in a region as diverse as the Miami Valley region was. And he could appeal to all of them. And I think that was part of the strength that he had. He brought that. He also gave enough freedom to people like Ann, let's say, who was dedicated on the housing program. I mean, she made that her cause. And it was his cause too, but he had to be broader in scope and see things broader. He had to add that breadth to the view, and she could be more focused. But he allowed that to take place. He brought differing views in, and he had those views close to him. I mean, many represented part of the Dayton community. And that was an internal part of the program. She was an integral part of the staff. That was part of his whole thing, bringing diversity together.
And during your time at MVRPC and other regional consortia, did you perceive that the federal government and under various HUD directors changed their support or approach for regional solutions to problems?
Oh, the federal government was, in a sense, constantly changing and never totally consistent or let's put it that way.
Yeah.
There were, at least during the period that we're talking about, there were programs within the federal government that if a region wanted to focus on and use those programs to strengthen themselves, they could do so. Now, those programs changed over time. At a time, for a long while, it was under HUD. Then there was more of it that was, to some degree, under the Environmental Protection Agency. Then more of it was under the Transportation Agency. I mean, I've worked it with and under all of them, you know, and by the time, I left SCAG in 1988, we were working on transportation planning, but an awful lot of the focus was on solving the air quality problems of Los Angeles. It shifted, but there dependent on who wanted to accomplish what, you know. There was, as long as I was at SCAG, they were still reviewing housing projects and involved in that. Water and sewer projects were, you know, all of these things were part of it. Now, how much what they're doing today, I don't know. This is 25 years after that, so I'm not sure what's happened.
Right. Yeah. Certainly, it seems like it was an exciting time, the 1970s, for planning and for regionalism generally.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. And that was a great little bite-sized piece of that, the stories that you got to bring to us here today. So is there anything else that you'd like to add to the record?
No, not particularly. If you have any other questions, I'll certainly try to answer them, but...
Yeah, would that be all right? So it's good to follow up on some of these things, because I actually wasn't as familiar with various things like the comprehensive plan and things like this. Maybe we could follow up at another date after
I... Oh, certainly.
Would that be all right?
Yes, no
That's
problem.
Because it's always an iterative process. You've got to find new information, look into it, and then ask more questions. So, great. Well, then I guess this will conclude our part one, we'll call it. And
okay.
I'll stop the recorder now.